Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, the 2nd of January, usually a forgotten day on the calendar after the more celebrated day before. In 2012, even more so because of what comes on the 3rd. The economics of the Iowa caucuses today, and what else is news in the new year from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 2nd of January. Good to have you here on what is technically the first working day of 2012. Politicians, though, have been working in Iowa for months now, years in some cases, and the payoff comes tomorrow. The Iowa caucuses will be the first time in what's already been a long campaign that anybody is going to stand up and actually be counted. And between the candidates and their entourages and Lord knows the press corps rolling on through, the caucuses make a nice little New Year's present for hotels and restaurants in the Hawkeye State. The long-term impact, though, can be even richer, as Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon reports.
Centro is one of downtown Des Moines' swankier restaurants, a place where President Obama has eaten and a popular spot with politicians, their staffers, and well-known journalists. It's one of those places getting a small sliver of the millions spent leading up to the Iowa caucuses.
This is a huge spot for people who are coming in not only to cover the caucuses, the press, but also stargazers who want to see press downtown Des Moines. They know that Centro is one of the top places to see folks.
Chris Diebel is the marketing director for Centro. He says the restaurant has gotten a 10% boost in revenue some caucus years, and the numbers are up this year. But Iowa State University economist Dave Swenson isn't all that impressed. He analyzed campaign spending before the very competitive 2008 Iowa caucuses. It added up to less than 0.01% of the state's GDP, just a few hundred jobs.
So it's not a big deal. It doesn't drive our economy.
So what do the caucuses do for Iowa?
It provides a lot of exposure for the state of Iowa, a lot of media coverage of the state of Iowa. To a certain degree, it covers our issues that people think are important.
Like farm policy. Swenson says that's why most candidates make promises to continue subsidies and tax breaks for corn-based ethanol, whether or not they make economic sense. Dave Miller is with the Iowa Farm Bureau. He says that federal support has helped insulate agriculture during this economic downturn.
It is jobs for rural America. It is better pricing and better asset values for Iowa farmers. Yeah, we care a lot about biofuels policy. And the caucuses allow us an opportunity to have interaction and debate with presidential candidates with regards to that type of policy.
And if you believe the industry's numbers, it's no small value. The State Renewable Fuels Association estimates Iowa biofuels were worth about $13 billion in 2010 alone and created 49,000 jobs. In Des Moines, I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
Nothing doing on Wall Street today, but elsewhere in the world there was some trading going on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was, hard though it may be to believe, actually some economic data out today, something called the Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, for the month of December. It's a sense of how manufacturing is doing around the world, how fast goods are being made and delivered, among other things. Looking at that and some other indicators, Marketplace's David Gura says the news, well, it ain't all bad.
No economist I talked to would tell me straight up he's optimistic. I heard a lot of modifiers, cautiously optimistic, reasonably optimistic. Mark Zandi is with Moody's Analytics.
I don't think 2012 is going to be a breakout year for the economy. It should be okay, but I don't think we're going to take off.
But he says that's because it's an election year more than anything else. Lately, we've gotten some pretty good data on the housing market and jobs.
I think we are seeing signs of the economy's improving.
That's Alex Brill, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The four-week average of how many Americans filed for unemployment for the first time is at its lowest level in more than 3 years. Mark Vittner is a senior economist at Wells Fargo.
We're entering the new year with a good bit of momentum.
But, and I heard a lot of buts today, there are many Americans who've been out of work for a really long time. And even though we added a net 2 million jobs last year, Mark Zandi says something's holding back the labor market.
Hiring levels are still very, very low by historical standards, so we've got a long way to go, but it feels like we're moving in the right direction.
Economists are saying the same thing about where the housing market's headed. We've seen construction pick up, and pending home sales were strong last month. Heather Boucher is chief economist at the Center for American Progress. She says the housing market's back to where it was a decade ago.
One friend of mine was noting that it's not like ringing in 2012. It's been more like ringing in 2001.
And then there's what's happening overseas. Economists will continue to keep a close watch on Europe in 2012 because of how it could affect the U.S. economy. And today's PMI numbers tell us something important about that. There are grounds to be even more reasonably optimistic. The data show India and China are participating in the global economic recovery despite what's happening in Europe. If they weren't, that could slow down growth in the U.S. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The end of the year is typically bonus time for a lot of people who work in corporate America. By contrast, some of the working poor get their small bumps at the beginning of the year. Eight states increased their minimum wages yesterday to keep pace with inflation. Depending on where you live, the increase was between 28 and 37 cents. It's not a whole lot, but as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports, that small change does have a big impact.
4 years ago, Kelly Wiedemer didn't count her pennies. With a job in financial services, she didn't need to.
My base salary was $67,500 plus bonus, so I was right at the $70,000 mark.
Then she lost her job. In her mid-40s, Wiedemer couldn't find a comparable position in her industry. After years with no work, she took a job as a gas station cashier for minimum wage.
I'm now the working poor. I'm now among the working poor for the first time in my life.
She lives in Colorado, one of eight states that increased the minimum wage to match inflation.
The increase helps to offset the rising cost of food at the grocery store. Effectively, without that increase, it would be a lot like just having a pay cut, frankly, because that same dollar won't go as far at the grocery store.
In Colorado, the raise is a modest 28 cents, but it's worth considering that in the last year, Wiedemer has had to do without things like toothpaste or shampoo, saving pennies for the essentials.
Even more important is food for my dog. So every one of those pennies and those dollars add up to help pay for those things that I used to take for granted.
The recession has forced more Americans into low-wage jobs where the pay has been shrinking.
During the recession, the median wage in lower-wage occupations fell 2.3%.
That's Paul Sohn with the National Employment Law Project. He says boosting the minimum wage helps counter the impact of flat or falling wages.
That's not only hard for working families at the bottom, but it's terrible for our economy.
He says the economy benefits when poor people get a raise because they typically spend that money immediately. For Kelly Wiedemer, that raise also helps offset another trend in low-wage industries.
My hours are going to be cut. They've informed me that my hours will be reduced here starting probably next week.
Happy New Year, Kelly. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
All right, here's my dirty little secret about working on a holiday. I had the NHL's Winter Classic on NBC on in my office while I was writing the show today. It's the National Hockey League's throwback game, a nod to the olden days of outdoor hockey. Philadelphia Flyers versus the Rangers this year. CNBC's in reruns because of the holiday, in case you're wondering. But anyway, every 30 seconds or so, it seemed, Bob Costas and all the rest were talking about the NBC Sports Network that launches today. Now, not all that long ago, there was really just one choice if we were in the market for all sports all the time, the Entertainment and Sports Programming Network, ESPN in the vernacular. But NBC's corporate parent Comcast has taken the sports channel Versus and rebranded it to get a piece of the all sports pie. Sally Herships has the story.
Imagine doing business without competition. That's pretty much how ESPN has it.
There is no other alternative. So they've been able to raise the rates as high as the market would bear and to some extent beyond that.
Larry Gerbrandt is an analyst with Media Valuation Partners. He says ESPN charges cable companies $4.76 per user. For comparison, TNT, which is also considered pricey, is just over a dollar. Gerbrandt says ESPN's owner, Disney, has even talked about raising the rate to $10 a user.
No cable operator wants to face their subscribers and say, I'm sorry, ESPN's gotten too expensive. We're not going to carry it anymore.
Instead, Comcast has decided to create its own sports channel. It helps that it owns NBC, which already has Sunday Night Football, the Tour de France, and the Olympics. Gerbrandt says sports TV is good business. ESPN makes more money than ABC, but it has a lock on most sports coverage. So what is NBC planning to show on its new 24/7 sports channel?
If you look at what the various networks of ESPN have, they have plenty of fill.
Fill, you know, news, talk, analysis. That's Harvey Schiller, former VP of sports programming for Turner Broadcasting. He says shows like ESPN Sports Center take up a majority of the day.
If you add up the actual number of games that they have, it's not that many.
NBC knows it won't have a shot at TV contracts for baseball and basketball for the next few years. But the network says it's already launched two new talk shows and a documentary unit. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Of the five human senses, hearing is the first to develop. It happens in the womb, and we process audio all the time, all day, all night, all year long. In short, our hearing never shuts off. So as most of you head back to work tomorrow after the holiday season, some insight now into how what we hear might affect how we do our jobs. Alex Doman is the co-author of the book Healing at the Speed of Sound. Alex, welcome to the broadcast.
Great to be here, Kai.
So you've done a lot of work, actually, on sound and work and how people do their jobs. So let me run you my personal specifics. I'm a journalist. I spend a decent amount of time sitting in front of a computer in my office. It's a little solitary for the last couple hours before deadline as I'm writing the show. Talk to me about what I ought to listen to.
Well, I think, first of all, Kai, you should listen to what works for you and what you enjoy. So it's not so much the musical genre as the underlying elements within the music, the tempo or the pacing of the music, the frequency or tone spectrum of the music. So if you want something to help you really focus and concentrate, instrumental music in the Baroque period of tempos of 50 to 60 beats per minute would be ideal.
Sounds a little clinical.
You know, I think we first of all need to look at the intuitive. You know, what feels right to us is what's right. But we like to give people a direction in terms of what they can look at in creating their own personal playlist.
All right, so let me play something for you. Mozart, Allegro Spirituoso, I'm told by my producer. Here's the thing. That would make me fall asleep.
Well, if that's not right for you, then that's not what you want to listen to. So when you're looking for something that feels good musically, what do you go to, Kai?
Yeah, I don't know. I usually prefer something a little poppier, a little more modern, you know.
Maybe some Red Hot Chili Peppers opposed to Mozart?
Yeah, yeah. You know who I'm listening to lately? I'm listening to The National, and I'm listening to The Cults. I don't know if you know them.
I don't. My current favorite is I listen to a lot of Adele.
Oh, yeah. Well, Mozart, if that's your thing, or The National, if that's my thing. I mean, how does that physiologically help you out? What does it do for you?
Well, music has different effects, Kai. So one, it can entrain. So depending on the tempo of the music, it can entrain your body rhythms, your breath rate, your heart rate, and help to change your body functions for the positive. Mm. It can set the tone and the pace for what you're doing. So you use music with positive lyrics if you want to improve mood, with faster tempos if you want to get moving, and with slower tempos if you want to relax and de-stress yourself.
Here's another question, though, I had about work and sound specifically. We are inundated with people talking in the next cube, with phones ringing, with trucks rattling by outside. What's the cost of sound to us?
Well, the cost of noise is great, Kai. Noise may be one of our most pervasive pollutants. I recently reviewed a World Health report that indicated noise is the second leading cause of environmental ill health, second only to air pollution in Europe.
Well, what is one to do when daily life is the urban soundtrack? Whether it's a subway train or a bus or your kids screaming in the back seat, you know.
There's so much we can do based on where we live. So if we're commuting on public transportation, we can use earplugs or noise cancellation headphones. use personal listening devices, two soundtracks that make us feel good is a way to help block out some of that background noise and do what we can to avoid, you know, obvious noise sources that are around us. You know, that information of knowing that noise is a pollutant is the first step.
Alex Doman is the founder and CEO of a company called Advanced Brain Technologies. He is the co-author with Don Campbell of a book called Healing at the Speed of Sound. Alex, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, so you're looking for work, you say. Well, here's what you got to do.
Start acting like a solution provider. Start acting more like a consultant, a problem solver.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed here and in London today, but there was some trading going on in Europe. Those somewhat decent PMI numbers we talked about up top gave investors a reason for a little bit of optimism. The German DAX closed up 3% today, 6,075 the number. The French CAC 40, which wrapped up last year 17% lower than whence it began, did see a 2% bump to end the day at 32.22. In Asia, most indices were closed as well, but South Korea's benchmark index, the KOSPI, closed flat today at 18.26, though it lost 11% of its value in the year 2011. The bright spot there was the tech sector. Samsung and LG Electronics, you saw a 2% gain. Overall, most of the world's leading indices are coming off a not-so-hot year, as you might guess. Britain's FTSE fell 5.6% by the end. Japan's Nikkei lost 17%, its lowest close since 1982. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee releases minutes for its December meeting. GOP presidential candidates face off at the Iowa Republican caucuses. And it's the 19th anniversary of the START II treaty between Russia and the U.S. Presidents George H.W. Bush and Boris Yeltsin signed the agreement in 1993, eliminating roughly two-thirds of each nation's nuclear stockpiles. I'm Justin Ho.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. APM's another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdal. This is, for a lot of people, a time to reconsider their lives. Take a step back and do more of the good stuff and less of the bad. New Year's resolutions, of course. We've all done them with varying degrees of success. And among the most popular things people decide to do, lose weight and get their finances in order. And, says financial planner Robert Brokamp, those two things are more alike than you'd think. Robert, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
So listen, there's a little cognitive dissonance here. You get paid to help people take care of their money, but we're talking about weight loss? Help me out.
Yep, absolutely. Actually, there's a lot in common there between money management and blubber management. I think it's probably the same neural pathways in your brain in terms of wanting to consume something and then having some regret about it later.
All right. So how did this epiphany come to you, if I could use a seasonally appropriate phrase?
Well, it, of course, started with me gaining too much weight and realizing probably about 18 months ago or so that if I don't do something about it, I have to buy a whole new wardrobe. And so that set off alarm bells in the financial part of my brain as well as the ego part of my brain. So I said, I got to lose some weight.
All right. Well, first, I want the numbers. How much did you weigh?
I weighed about 205. So not horrible. I didn't look horribly overweight, but it definitely would have required new pants.
And what'd you do?
Well, the thing I did was the smart thing you're supposed to do, which is just make small modifications to my habits so that it would be sustainable. But I found it actually didn't really do enough for me. I you know, ate a little less, exercised a little more, but I only lost a few pounds. Mm-hmm. So the real dilemma I had was, do you go extreme? And it's the same with finances as well. And that I think actually a period of going very extreme for a while will show you enough progress to provide the motivation you need to keep going.
Well, much as you can go extreme with dieting to a point, you will eventually have a tub of Ben and Jerry's Cherry Garcia, not that I know what that's like at all. and you will also financially go out and spend $350 on a pair of sunglasses.
Right, absolutely. And to be quite honest, at some point you should go back to a point where you allow yourself to do those every once in a while. But hopefully you've made so much progress that you don't want to give it all back. So that time when you have that tub of Ben and Jerry's or you go out and buy those sunglasses, you say, okay, I just did this one little slip up, or it was already in my budget, so I can do that. But now I'm going to get back to habits that are healthier for me physically and financially.
Is there a, I guess the phrase is public accountability mechanism that might help?
There are several ways of doing this, actually, and there are several websites like fatbet.net where you put money on the line.
I'm sorry, fatbet.net?
Fatbet.net.
All right, I'm going to check that out.
Absolutely. And then there was a great book called Willpower written by a New York Times columnist and a psychologist, and they talked about the public humiliation diet of a guy named Drew Magry who would tweet his weight every day. And now there is a site called Tweet What You Spend. So you sort of get out there and say, listen, I'm going to lose weight or I'm going to get my budget in line. And I'm going to tell all of you what I'm eating, what I'm spending, so you can help me stay in line here.
My father, were he listening to this right now, would say, you know what? Both of these, while there may be some connections, it's fundamentally about willpower.
Absolutely. It's actually, it operates like a muscle in that if you use it a lot at one point, it'll tire itself out. But you are gradually building up sort of a resistance to it. So you use that in some ways in that you don't go shopping or go to the grocery store if you are tired or upset or anything like that because you've already worn out your willpower. But you make little changes so that you can build up new habits. So over the long term, you actually have more willpower.
Yeah. You're a financial professional, so I'll guess your spending habits are fine. How's your weight, man? How you doing?
I'm at about 180 right now.
Good.
And I did actually have to buy a new wardrobe, except this time it was to buy pants with a smaller waistline instead of a bigger waistline.
There you go.
So I'm doing all right.
Good for you. Happy New Year, man.
Thank you. To you too.
Robert Brokamp, he's a certified financial planner and he's a senior advisor at The Motley Fool. Robert, thanks a lot.
Great to be here.
The first grade A economic indicator of 2012 drops this Friday morning. It's the December jobs report. No prognostications as of yet. Economists get New Year's off, too, you know. But as of right now, the unemployment rate in this country is 8.6%, the best it's been in more than 2 years. That is still historically high, but if the rate is going down, and it is, then somebody's getting hired, right? We sent Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman off to figure out what's behind a job hunt success.
It's a hallmark moment at Willamette Valley Animal Hospital in Salem, Oregon. Two little girls, their mom, and the frightened Chihuahua puppy they just got from the pound are visiting the vet for the first time. And here's the young animal doc, just out of vet school, Megan Weekly.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Dr. Weekly.
So this is Lucky. How long do you have Lucky?
2 days.
How are we adjusting so far?
I'm a little shy.
For Weekly, treating family pets in a suburban strip mall is more than a hallmark moment. It's a godsend. After graduating with a diploma from Oregon State University and $130,000 in student loan debt, the young vet looked for work for well over a year without success.
So for a while, I mainly looked within reasonable driving distance, and then as months went by, I expanded to all of the state, and every place I'd go, you know, there were so many other experienced people looking for jobs, so.
Did you despair at any point?
I did. I mean, my husband has a good job and was able to support me. Towards the end, I was going around the state, handing out resumes, you know, walking in clinics, and that's how I ended up getting this job, was walking in.
She was lucky she landed a job close to home. John Madigan's the man who hired her.
If someone has enough initiative to drive and hand deliver a resume to every single veterinarian in the Willamette Valley, this person must really want a job.
Madigan's vet clinic has expanded right through the recession, but at the time Megan Weekly walked through the door, he didn't have a job to offer. Still,
what I can't teach is attitude, and she had a phenomenal attitude. And I think all employers, whether it's for me or small business or large business, we look to buy attitude.
And so he did, bringing her on full time. And here's the thing. With so few jobs being created and so many people competing for them, you have to offer a potential employer something unique so they'll pick you out of the crowd.
The woman you're describing was very lucky. She just happened to hit it at the right time with the right person. I think it's the needle in the haystack approach.
Career coach Ford Myers is author of the book Get the Job You Want Even When No One's Hiring, and he insists success is much more likely to come from an entrepreneurial mindset. First, identifying and targeting a few carefully chosen professional connections, and then working them, whether face-to-face or via social media sites like LinkedIn.
Stop presenting yourself as a candidate, stop acting like an applicant, and instead start acting like a solution provider, start acting more like a consultant, a problem solver.
Outplacement expert John Challenger agrees that rising above a crowded field often requires this same entrepreneurial approach. And since many employers have doubts about hiring the long-term unemployed, he says selling yourself may mean lowering your price.
Sometimes it may come down to a negotiation where you might say to that employer, I'm open to taking something less, but let me prove it to you. And if you like the work I've done, would you consider paying me at the level that I was making before?
And Challenger says if you have been out of work for a while, make sure you've got something to show for it.
It makes sense to take volunteer work, project or part-time work. Say you took time off to take care of an aging parent. Explain that not only in the resume and put that in, but in the interview.
Megan Weekly, the young vet, did all that, volunteering, working at the Humane Society. She says it kept her skills current and her spirits up, but she's pretty sure what landed her a job in the end wasn't listing all that stuff on the resumes that she hand-delivered up and down the state. It was just the fact that she showed up. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out. Were this a regular first working day of the month, we'd have been informed as to the relative health or continued problems of the American automobile industry. Those numbers usually do come out on the first. We'll get them Wednesday this month, fourth for some reason. But anyway, best guesses are Detroit did pretty well in 2011. Almost 13 million cars and trucks sold last year. A healthy car market, the experts say, about 14 million. So, progress. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media on this Monday. U.S. markets were closed today, as we said. Our producers include Avshai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, how GOP presidential hopefuls are getting a real bargain.
We'll have these outside groups promoting specific candidates, and that really becomes an extension of the candidate's campaign.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.